Hello and welcome back to Romaniacs, the podcast that promises not to share your data with Cambridge Analytica. Like David Miliband, we're trying to put a brave face on being pipped to the post by Ed Miliband. We'd like to congratulate Ed and his Reasons to Be Cheerful co-host Jeff Lloyd for winning the Broadcasting Press Guild's first award for best podcast last week. We were just happy to be nominated. However, we will be moving to New York at the end of the show. I'm Doria Linsky, and with me this week are two of our regular presenters. Naomi Smith is a former Lib Dem parliamentary candidate and now chief operating officer at Best for Britain, the campaign group that's fighting for a yes or no vote on the final deal. Hi, Naomi. How are you?
I'm really good, thanks. Yeah. I don't actually start until after Easter, so I can't reveal too many trade secrets just yet.
But after Easter,
Oh, everything, yeah.
It's a shame you weren't here last week when we did Soft Border Patrol, because you could have helped us with the accents. I mean, we didn't try.
Why not?
In your absence. Don't try and lure me into showing why I didn't try.
Just have to start with high eyebrow and Kai. It's really easy.
I can actually... My Irish accent
is awful.
Isn't...
No, no. I thought it was all... I thought it was
no, no, okay, right, all right, all right, fine. Yeah.
Also, with us, there's Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk. Hi, Ian. Do you feel heartbroken by a trouncing by Ed?
Yes, no, completely emotionally shattered by that experience. We need another vote, I presume, second referendum.
On the terms of the award.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
And we have a very special guest with us today, someone whose political career has run through all the events that led up to Brexit. Alastair Campbell was Tony Blair's fearsome communications director, widely thought to be the model for the thick of its Malcolm Tucker, although he has no comment to make at this time. He's now editor-at-large at The New European, where he writes a weekly column railing against what he calls the catastrophically stupid decision of Brexit. He's also a mental health campaigner and GQ's chief interviewer, where his subjects include politicians, athletes, and indeed himself. He is the Romaniac's Romaniac, and he's here with us today. Hi, Alastair, how are you?
I'm all right, I suppose, given all that's going on in the world.
A lot of Brexit on your plate at the moment?
Fair bit of Brexit, yeah. Brexit, well, I dream about Brexit quite a lot. Yeah, it's not good, is it? It's not good to dream about it. I dreamt about Trump the other night as well.
Oh, that's a nightmare.
Which is really horrible. And also, did I hear you right that Ed didn't win?
No, he did.
He won. Well, he didn't win when it counted, but he did win.
No. But I thought you just said his co-host, Jeff, won it.
No, it was to Ed and his co-host.
Oh, they both won.
Yeah, they both won.
Well, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned GQ. He's my latest victim in GQ.
Oh.
So there you go.
There we go.
So he's on the streets, in the shops now.
Good cross-platform promotion there.
Award-winning podcaster.
And Ed Miliband is not as angry about Brexit as I believe he should be.
Hmm.
Well, it's because he's got his podcast now. He doesn't.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I mean, I said to him, you could have been, like, you know, dealing with Putin and China and all these big things as Prime Minister, and you're doing a podcast. It's not quite the same, is it? But he is getting he's definitely getting a lot out of it. And I think he does sort of think of it as a, he actually described it as a sort of bit of a digital think tank. So, I mean, if he's getting ideas, fine, you know, it's good. It's good. And it's a hard thing to get over a really big defeat like that. So I think he's finding himself again, I'd say.
Well, I always wanted to see a book called Losers, in which it was a series of interviews with people, you know, sports people.
Well, I wrote one called Winners.
But there you go. Probably easier to get the interviewers.
Hi, Jose. Dear Mr. Mourinho, I'm writing a book about winners. Would you like to be on think about that?
Success has losers. Many parents, but failure is an orphan. Huh?
Yeah. Can you talk about the worst night of your life for us, please? It's a tough ask.
Yeah, but you know, there are more losers in the world than winners, in terms of campaigns, in terms of sports events, and you know, how many people are going to win the Champions League this?
Let's do a podcast on it. We could have an entire podcast called Losers, where we only interview people that, you know.
Well, what do you think this is? We lost. We lost. And if you tell
we're
me
going
that,
to be winners.
Okay. Cool. Good. Yeah.
We'll talk to Alistair and Depp.
By the way, Ian said second referendum. Never, ever say second referendum.
No, we've discussed this. But
well, don't.
Yeah, on the other hand, I'm not a campaigner. I'm a journalist. That's basically what it is.
No, it's not. Well, what was back in the 70s? That was the first referendum.
It's called a people's vote now.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. Yes. Ian, shut up.
Took just 3 minutes so far before you get out.
Stop ruining the people's vote.
Yeah.
We'll talk to Alistair more later, plus Theresa May's transition deal, what's in it and how much do the Brexit ultras hate it on a scale of 1 to 1 billion. Cambridge Analytica, after the Observer and Channel 4 exposed the shady clearinghouse of political data, they've been kicked off Facebook and arrest warrants have been sought. What does that say about Trump, Brexit and the power of social media? and a new comic about Brexit called The Brexit. All this and more after these important messages from Naomi.
A quick reminder, if you're listening on Friday or Saturday and you're in the north of England, then don't forget to go to the Great Northern March Against Brexit in Leeds on Saturday the 24th. Show your dissatisfaction with Article 50 on the anniversary of Theresa May triggering it. It starts at 11 a.m. on the hedgerow in front of the City Library, and speakers include friends of the podcast, Lord Adonis, AC Grayling and Sue Wilson from Bromain in Spain. You can find out more at stopbrexitmarch.com. Meanwhile, we're happy to say we've passed 500 backers on Patreon for Romaniacs. Backers get mugs, T-shirts and bags and, of course, advance tickets for the next Romaniacs Live, as well as exclusive recordings of our first show. Sign up and add our voice to the sound of the crowd. Find out more at Romaniacs.com or go to patreon.com/RomaniacsCast. Join in and own the Ramone.
Thanks, Naomi. I'm actually going to the Leeds March. I'm getting out of my metropolitan, well, this metropolitan bubble, and moving to another metropolitan bubble. Yeah,
it's a great metropolitan bubble.
It's good because there's a few around the country that you get to choose from. Now, it's a dirty job, but someone's got to do the Brexit news. The elephant's pregnancy, that is the Brexit transition deal, finally came to term on Monday when Theresa May struck an agreement with Brussels on what life will supposedly be like in the interim period after Brexit. On the upside, we'll be retaining the benefits of the single market and customs union for about 2 years, and EU citizens will be treated the same during the transition period as they are now. On the downside, the Irish border is still up in the air. Not literally up in the air, although that is one of the options on the table. In case of no agreement, a backstop of regulatory alignment with the EU will be written into the transition deal. And Tory MPs were so furious at the abject betrayal of British fish that they threw them into the Thames from a trawler. So it was a bit of a flop. Jacob Rees-Mogg, who warned against Britain becoming a joke nation, was unable to board the boat because they had not received permission for it to dock. But Nigel Farage was on there and threw some fish and then went home.
Thanks, so Nigel.
It's exactly these kind of like skillful theatrics that's made in the politician ears. Douglas Ross, the Moore MP, said it would be easier to get someone to drink a pint of cold sick than to sell this as a success. Ian, you wrote they've just kicked the Brexit can further down Uncertainty Street. Did you?
Did I write that? That's actually more elegantly put. Yeah.
we've added Uncertainty Street, but you can have that.
Thanks.
So is it a climb down?
Not really. I mean, there was a chance that the EU at this point, even to get out of the sort of the transition discussion, was going to say, look, you need to have fixed Ireland by now. And they didn't do that. I don't think there was a big chance of that happening. So it's not a particularly major victory for the government to have gotten past that stage. But all that really happens to us as we do this is that we just get closer and closer to the end point with that Irish problem right in the heart of the negotiation. The Irish problem cannot be fixed. There is no solution to that issue that exists in the world. It's not like taking a goods-only deal like we have, as we're going to be presented with in the third phase of negotiation now, where we have to say, well, look, OK, so we're just going to swallow it and we're going to take it. At least there, even though you make the compromise, you take the hit, you take the pain, there is a solution to be found. That is not the case with Ireland. There is no solution there. So this ball of unsolvable problem just gets kicked and kicked and kicked, and where it is now is it's going to explode right when we get to autumn, when things get rather climactic.
Mogg had an idea, though, to solve it.
He did.
Which was the Ireland leaves as well.
Yes. Now, that probably won't work out overall. I think that one may not have been thought through.
Alistair, you were part of the team that negotiated the Good Friday Agreement, which seems to be treated in rather cavalier fashion these days. Does that sort of irresponsibility sort of make you despair?
Well, it adds yet another layer of despair about the various levels of irresponsibility through the whole thing, one of which actually was the fact that it barely figured during the referendum debate. I went over to Ireland several times and I was saying to the Irish business community, you've got to get involved in this because, you know, this is going to affect you, you're going to be collateral damage, to use a horrible phrase. But the board, I agree with Ian. By the way, I disagree with Ian that this didn't represent a whole series of climb downs. I think if you go back to how the negotiating strategy started out, whether it's on the cost, whether it's on some of the further concessions they have to give, you'd have to say the European Union's have kind of got what they wanted.
Oh, everything that they want.
Yeah. And where I do agree with Ian is that if I think in the time that we've had since the referendum, if there was a way of having the border without with us out and Ireland in, the European Union and having a border that had no kind of infrastructure and no people and no men with guns and no people filling in forms as they crossed it, we'd have thought of it by now. Somebody would have thought of this. And so I think that the... And do you know what I think has happened with the European Union side of the things? I think you've got very different dynamics going on. Basically, what they... I think at the start, they thought, oh, God, let's just, you know, see how it goes and see whether actually there's going to be a big shift and the Brits might actually change their mind. And while that was going on, I think they were being very, you know, sort of bending over backwards in all sorts of ways. I think as negotiations have gone on, somebody said that somebody I was talking to in one of the European capitals said that, you know, the problem you've got is you've got very, very serious issues being dealt with by very non-serious people. Mm. And I think that's what they feel about us now. They don't really take this seriously. So they're sort of saying, well, we'll sort... They think they will find a way to sort it out. They think we're gone. Now, I keep trying to persuade them, no, it's if, not when. This can still be wrestled back. But I think they have slightly given up on us. And so I think that's what Barnier was reflecting, to be honest. I don't think it was... I think he was just saying, well, we'll work it out. He was kind of in a fairly insouciant mode as he went through it. So I think we are... And this kind of, you know, I think the fish thing is really interesting because Barnier also said, by the way, that... And I mean, I don't have the figures in my head as to what proportion the fishing industry is to our national economy compared to the city and financial services, but I know that financial services is a hell of a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. And Barnier is basically saying, we're not going to give you what you want on that either. Mm. And you're going to have to suck it up. And yet it's because of the kind of the symbolism of the fish and because of the sort of pictorial power of boats going down past Parliament, what have you, there's all the focus on that. So I think that just adds to the sense that we're just not being taken very seriously in these negotiations, I'm afraid.
It all felt very sort of Fawlty Towers, you know, don't mention the war. I only mentioned it once and I think I got away with it. It was like, don't mention Ireland. Whatever you do, you sort of won't mention Ireland. That seems to be what this sort of whole fallout from the transition seems to have been. I mean, I'm not sure, Ian, that it'll come to a head in the autumn. I suppose by the June summit, the EU will have really pushed for a decision or a solution to Ireland. I don't know that it'll drag on through the summer, but it sort of can't really come quickly enough. And I mean, I'm sort of interested in the definition of the backstop arrangement that was in the joint statement in December, because I don't fully understand whether Theresa May absolutely thinks that backstop is just Northern Ireland maintaining regulatory alignment with the customs union and single market, or whether she means the whole of the UK.
So I don't think it, from the EU's perspective, it doesn't really matter. What they're talking about is that border in Ireland.
Yeah.
What Britain chooses to then do is up to itself. The way that the EU have put it is, goes, right, well, fine, if you don't all want to join in the customs union, then you're going to have that border in the Irish Sea.
Exactly.
There is, of course, this other alternative, which is just jump on in the boat.
Yeah, and so you're back to this DUP holding Theresa May by the short and curlies because they absolutely don't want that Irish Sea border. So, yeah, I mean, when we started this podcast, we were sort of thinking, oh, will there be enough Brexit news for every single week? And, you know, more fool us, because there absolutely was. Except on this issue, it's just we seem to be saying just the same stuff all the time because there has just been absolutely no progress.
I think, though, if it does go down that route, then, you know, watch Scotland come back into the equation as well.
Or fish, yeah.
Yeah, because I think that if and it is a very, very big if, and obviously she won't want to do it, but if that does turn out to be the only way around this problem, then you're conceding the idea that part of the UK should remain part of the arrangements that you're meant to be leaving. Well, then what does that say about the United Kingdom? And given that the Scots have, you know, still, the people keep going about opinion not shifting. Opinion, insofar as it is shifting in Scotland, is shifting even harder against the idea of the hard Brexit that Theresa May is pursuing. So I think that comes back into place. You'll be able to talk about that as well.
It's good to know. So my guess of how they came up with this arrangement and why they allowed it to take place is that they did put that backstop down in full in this agreement. Mm. They colour code the agreement green, yellow and white. White stands for stuff there's no agreement on, and of course basically the whole
like
of the Irish bit is white.
Exactly,
yellow, yeah. Tellingly, the whole thing is a bit of a trolling, I think. Now you get to that part. They don't just say by the way, to reiterate, unless you guys come up with your trade solution, unless you come up with a tech solution, this is what the backstop will take place. They then go and write out the backstop, and they write it out in detail, saying, look, you're going to be part of one regulatory body. This all comes in as one. Now, that is then presented by Barnier being up on the stage going, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So my hunch is it's clear the British government hasn't signed up to it yet, but it seems to me that the condition for talks to move past this second stage on transition onto the rest of it was that that was put down there in the text. And I think as things move, you're right that the next couple of months have all the real meetings over Ireland. But I don't think that domestically the agreement will be there in British terms in order to sign up to any of the scenarios that are on offer. So it keeps on rolling forward, rolling forward, rolling forward. But my hunch is that that thing just starts to sort of fossilize into something that is going to stay in that agreement and gets voted on. And that's when things get very, I think, you know, really quite intense indeed.
So one thing we've talked about is the idea that kind of that Theresa May is basically being bossed around by the ultras. Do you what do you make of how she's sort of handling these people? As somebody who's been in government yourself.
Well, she's very hard to read. And I don't know whether that's deliberate or not. I remember Nick Clegg once telling me that when David Cameron sometimes used to send him along to do the bilaterals with Theresa May because he found a reason not to do it. And that she has this ability to not be read, so that you might have a conversation with her and she says something, then you reply. And if she feels that she's already covered off the point in what she said before, she doesn't really kind of engage. Now, whether it's a shyness, people talk about being quite shy, whether it's just a kind of a lack of ability to relate to people, I don't know. If it's a kind of strategy, then not being read in a difficult negotiation is sometimes maybe not a bad thing. I mean, you know, you mentioned the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, it was sometimes very, very hard to work out, more so with the nationalists than the unionists, it has to be said, because the unionists tended to sort of, you know, just
never
say what they thought, you know. But, well, no, you had shades of opinion. But you sort of, they were quite, usually fairly easy to read, whereas the nationalists sometimes are quite difficult to read. But I think she made a terrible mistake on day one. And of course, when you start in something like that job, the first impressions are so important. She made very good impressions in terms of what she said on the steps of number 10, you know, the just about managing, remember them, going to focus on mental health, and that's gone pretty much nowhere, all these different things that she said. But the one thing she did on the referendum was she essentially did just set herself up there as the spokeswoman for the 52%. And I think that has guided her position ever since. Now, I had a conversation with a Tory MP a couple of weeks ago now, who said something that has really made a lot fall into place for me in terms of watching Theresa May. He said, you have to understand one thing about Theresa May. She is absolutely determined that the Conservative Party will not fall apart over this. Now, once you get that in your head, as I now have, it sort of makes sense that what she's really driving her is holding the Conservative Party together.
Which is what drove Cameron to have the referendum in the first place.
Yeah, but that's what ultimately is...
It's the downfall of many a Tory leader.
The downfall of him.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's gone. But I think that you know, she's been driven by that. So when she makes that speech, Mansion House speech, when she responds as she did to this later round of negotiation, you can sort of see it the whole time. You know, she's saying this to keep them happy and this to keep them happy. And then as they sort of flake off, she's analysing how hard it is going to be to get them back on board. And thus far, from a purely from that perspective, you'd have to say she's done not bad. The tragedy is it's just terrible for the country, which is meant to be her job.
It's still the nicest thing anyone's ever said about Theresa May on this podcast.
Is it? Well, I really don't want that accolade. Is it?
No, but I suppose. Oh, I don't know. Matthew Paris already said something.
I'm trying to give it. I'm trying. The thing is
that she's succeeding in the job of leading the Conservative Party, but failing in the job of Prime Minister.
She's totally failing the job of Prime Minister because the job of leadership, ultimately, I think, is to face a country, the country that you lead, up to the challenges that you really face, and then to have a strategy for them. In her heart, I think she thinks this is a disaster. Now, I don't know that because she's very hard to read on that as well. But it's interesting that whenever she and Hammond, whenever they've been asked about whether they think this is, you know, going to damage us, I thought it was interesting, the Mansion House speech, she for the first time admitted this is going to probably make us poorer. You know, when you're the Prime Minister and you're doing that knowingly, that's got to weigh quite heavily on you. So I just think purely from that party management point of view, they have not imploded. I think this idea that Labour sort of sitting around thinking, oh, we're going to have an election anytime soon, I just don't think that's going to happen. I think even if she lost the vote, and I hope she does lose the vote on the deal, but I think even the politics might drive you beyond where they want to be, but it's not automatic. And she does seem, you know, sorry to say something else moderately positive about her from my perspective, but...
He's on a roll.
No, she does seem to have a bit of resilience going for her. You need.
You think even if Parliament voted against the motion that the Conservatives could survive, the motion on the whole of the withdrawal treaty at the end of the whole process?
I think the politics make it very, very, very difficult. But, I mean, look, if you just think back to the election, you know, she was a goner. George Osborne, what was it, Dead Woman Walking? And she sort of kept going. And so I think that the one thing the Tories... I mean, these Tories... I remember once Alan Clark, my fellow diarist, and he and I were quite good mates from my journalism days because he was a very, very gossipy source, put it that way. But I remember he once phoned me up when we were in number 10. By the time we got into number 10, he once phoned me up. I can't remember what year it was. But he said, we were having a chat about this, that and the other, and he said, you're going to walk in the next election. I said, what do you mean? They said, I think it was between the first and second elections. He says, well, he says, the trouble, the thing you've got to understand is we now hate each other much more than we hate you. Mm. Now, I think they're sort of getting to that, but the Corbyn thing holds them together.
Yeah,
they really do have a kind of a dislike and a fear about the politics involved in that I think is so... I don't know. Mm. I don't know is the answer, but I don't think it's a done deal that should she lose a vote, she's a goner straight away.
It's more like the Irish question will force the DUP to make the decision for her. She may hold the party together, but not the country.
Okay. Next up, the Information Commissioner is seeking a warrant to raid the office of data crunching company Cambridge Analytica after an expose by The Observer and Channel 4. The Observer reported that Cambridge Analytica had gained unauthorised access to tens of millions of Facebook profiles, and Channel 4 recorded the company's chief executive, Alexander Nix, discussing using women as honey traps to compromise politicians. Nix later claimed it was a media vendetta based on his company's backing of Donald Trump. The company was, of course, founded by Steve Bannon and the Megabucks Mercer family. Cambridge Analytica has been kicked off Facebook, ensuring that now the horse has escaped, the door is firmly bolted. Have any of us used Cambridge Analytica's infamous personality quiz? Please click A for yes or B for no.
Do we know?
Which quiz it was?
How do we know?
You'd know if you took the quiz. You wouldn't know if you're the friend of someone who had taken the quiz, who had their data then sort of harvested out.
Yeah. I don't think... I didn't do that.
I would never do
that. If it would have been a quiz about, I don't know, how many of these records from the 90s do you remember?
Who's your favourite X-Man?
Possibly. They'd have got... It would have been a data bonanza for them.
From the when? The 90s?
I was just saying, like, because you know you see these silly quizzes and it'll be like, how many records do you remember from the 90s? And I'll be like, oh, okay then. It turns out to be really easy. And I was like, what's the point of that quiz? And now, of course, we know what the point of a lot of these...
Donald Trump elected.
So you did. I did recognise a lyric from Bartlett. Yeah, exactly. Is this? I mean, Facebook's share price is plunging, and Mark Zuckerberg has been called to speak to which committee would that be?
DCMS. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quaking in his boots.
Is anyone? It's a strongly worded letter. I'd love to see.
I'd love to see Zuckerberg there. Would he wear a shirt or keep to those stupid T-shirts he wears? Do you think he'd actually put a tie on?
I think he might.
I've never seen him in a tie.
I think he might think now is not the time to be just like Silicon Valley tech bro. What's up, guys?
I don't know. I think that... I'll tell you the first thing I want to say about this Cambridge Analytica thing is Carol Cadwalader at The Observer. She's fought a pretty lonely plough on this for quite a while.
A couple of years.
And, you know, I think with most of the rest of the media going, move on, you know, forget it, get on, what's she on about? And it's interesting how it's this that has taken it to a kind of sort of tipping point that people feel they really have to take it seriously. There wasn't, you know, the kind of things she's been saying the whole way through and providing the stories. And it's just been one of those stories that we've all kind of looked away from. So hats off to her. I think she's what I'd call a proper journalist in a world where there are too many just sort of, you know, filling space and doing what their bosses tell them. But I think as to where it goes now, you know, and here's where you have to step back from your own desires. I did on Instagram this morning, I did put out a picture of the now deleted tweet from Andy Wigmore about boasting that Cambridge Analytica were involved in the Brexit campaign and ditto
and Aaron Banks's
to Hugo Rifkin and all that. So hopefully somebody will come knocking at their door at some point. But I think it's I think what it does say, I mean, what I don't buy is the idea that all these people who voted Trump because somebody, you know, worked out what music they listened to in the 1990s. And I suspect that with these Cambridge Analytica, and particularly when you see the guy, you know, the undercover filming of that guy, Nix. Is his name Nix or is Alexander Nix?
Alexander.
And when you saw that, you think, I mean, there's so much sort of, you know, in a bullshit industry, they seem to me to have a lot of bullshit attached to what they do. Mm-hmm. And yet, the fact of them setting out from a very right-wing agenda to right-wingize the debate and the electorate, they do seem to have had some success in that. So I also feel, you know, I do a lot of, out in the speaking circuit, I do a lot about reputation management, and I always throw out names of people that are kind of globally known. And it's really interesting who people think has a good and bad reputation. And I've noticed Zuckerberg's, even before this, kind of on the decline for quite some time. Whereas a Bill Gates has kind of gone in the opposite direction, and I think it's because even in the modern age, even in this, and perhaps especially because we've now got Trump in the White House, people want to feel there is kind of purpose and values to what they do, and they don't see purpose and values in Facebook beyond Facebook in it for themselves.
Well, I think there's a lot of kind of argument about actually how, like you said, effective is it? I mean, some people are sort of going, well, you know, this was to blame for the referendum result, which seems an extreme claim. But on the other hand, I mean, I don't follow, most of my Facebook friends are not very right wing. But I have seen the left wing equivalent working. I have seen a few friends kind of circulating very dubious news stories from that kind of ecosystem of,
oh, for sure,
of left-wing sites. You've got to assume the same thing is happening on the right. And I've tried to argue with them and go, this seems a bit like an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Maybe you haven't noticed that, but this is what Rothschilds tends to mean. And they refuse to believe it.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of anecdotally, it's like this stuff, if you are creating a kind of like a little sort of, you know, propaganda bubble and social media, it does seem to have an effect. Now, whether you can say, you know, well, that challenges the validity of Trump's win or Leave's win, I think he's going too far. But the idea that it doesn't influence people at all.
It's not impossible, by the way, that it would have something to do with it, especially the Trump win. Trump win is comparatively few sort of voters. You're talking about tens of thousands, about 70,000, you know, a few
states
areas.
Or something.
So in that kind of scenario, remember, they're not. There is the whole thing of the values bit of, they buy this kind of biscuit, they go on that kind of holiday, so they're this kind of vote. Okay, so that's one thing. But that's not quite what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is the people did the test, then they harvested data of millions of other people. Now on that, I mean, remember, this can also be the data that someone transmits through Facebook Messenger. So you could say, for instance, if they have used, because of course it's all part of Facebook, it's your Facebook data. If you've used these set words, let's say someone in Britain uses some kind of racial slur.
I was going to say, listen,
Dorian
just looked really scared.
Yeah, no, I've noticed, look, all the colour has gone from Dorian's
face. For some reason I thought Facebook Messenger was as safe as a kind of like deep web coded channel.
I can assure you that it is not. And if someone uses, let's say, a racial slur of some kind, then you might target them with made up stories, essentially adverts that look like articles.
Exactly.
And you could target that towards a comparatively very small number of people to get some quite significant political results. So this stuff, I agree that when people start, there is a sort of emotional instinct to go, maybe Brexit's all just about because someone lied on Facebook and we need to deal with the realities of why Brexit happened and blah, blah. Of course we do. However, we're at an early stage now with a kind of technology and a kind of lack of morality around consent for how that technology is used online around politics, where we can stop this now if we come down hard on it now, and this would be a very good time to do so.
And I think I've heard Tim Berners-Lee speak really well about this, where he talks about, you know, we made a choice about content, whether to pay for it or whether to pay for it with our data, and my God, are we paying for it now? You know, having sort of made that decision.
What's that line? If it's free, then the product that's being sold is you.
Exactly, exactly that. Mm. Yeah, and just ever so quickly to link it all back to Brexit, I think what we do know is that Aggregate IQ, which is an organisation very closely linked to Cambridge Analytica, they had sort of data sharing licences with one another, received a massive donation from Theresa May's coalition partners in the DUP of the order of magnitude of, you know, sort of 30,000 plus pounds, as did lots of other organisations around leave.eu and even Vote Leave. And they all claimed at the time that they were working together. So Aaron Banks did, and Cambridge Analytica did, and other groups did. And they are now all saying, no, we were lying when we said that. Mm, so yeah. Which is it? They were either lying then or they're lying now.
He said
and that
times.
Does mean that this referendum was built on lies, and we have got a right to know. And even if it only made a very marginal difference, actually the result was pretty marginal. So we have rules and regulations for a reason, because because those expenses.
The result
limits,
is what it is, but we should know.
Absolutely.
What happened? Well, it would be useful if they could tell us the truth. Couldn't it? I mean, he does keep on saying. I mean, Alexander Hicks has said. He said at the beginning. He said in 2016. Yeah. He said in 2017 that they had links with leave.eu. They now say that was not the case. When he was in front of a Commons committee the other day, he was saying that they never harvested Facebook data, which we now know they absolutely did.
I think it's about time we got to the heart of it. Mr. Nix is going to need to rely on all of his old Etonian charm and survivability. And, I think he's in big trouble.
Well, if you have any thoughts about this, leave a comment on our Facebook page. Finally, very quickly, in Brighton News, there's a Brexit comic coming out. Sadly for Ian, it's not a Marvel-style superhero book featuring the uncanny Brexmen or the European Court of Justice League. That's our producer, Andrew. But a proper British comic in the style of Trumpton, featuring characters like Dealing Davis, British champion lightweight negotiator and Captain Brexit. Illustrator and author Mike Dix raised nearly £5,000 by crowdfunding for the first edition, which is going out next week. He used to run the Trumpton UKIP Twitter, which UKIP MEP David Coburn tried to shut down under copyright laws. So what do we think? Do we see the...
We like humour. We like humour. I actually think that... I did an event recently with Rory Bremner. We were in Cheltenham with this kind of very middle-aged, middle-class audience. And Rory Bremner is so funny and is such a great mimic and satirist. And I thought, why isn't he on telly every night? Mm. Where is Spitting Image? Mm. I think we have so little satire at the moment compared to the States. So I think a comic is a welcome addition, particularly as so many of the characters in... what other country but Britain could produce Jacob Rees-Mogg as a... quote, serious person in our political landscape. It's incredible.
Well, he is literally, I mean, because
people are laughing at us.
I mean, he is literally a Beano character.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he has, hasn't he?
What was he called?
Wasn't he Lord Snooty?
Yeah.
There's a really nice bit of the comic where they talk about Nasty Nigel having been given a job presenting at the BBC and presenting Question Time, which I really like that they're having a good old pop at the BBC. Serious point to make, though. Research and focus groups suggest that actually humour bombs quite badly with undecideds and soft leavers and remainers that we're trying to win over. It's very, very good for the soul of the ardent remainer. So in that, I think it's serving us really, really well. But I think we have to make sure that we're not looking like we're poking fun at people who were lied to. It's fine to poke fun at the liars, but there's quite a fine line between that and sort of making people that we need to win over to our side feel that we're not mocking them.
I think once you start putting comedy through focus groups, you're in trouble. I think comedy's just got to be comedy.
Yeah. But I think what I mean is it shouldn't be a channel for us.
Yeah.
But it is largely cathartic,
yes,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
Ben Elton did not bring down Margaret Thatcher. You know, I don't think many people were kind of watching.
But we have to have some fun along the way.
But I'll tell you what, I think Spitting Image...
brought down John Major.
No, I think it did for David Steele.
Oh, yes, that's right, in the pocket of David Owen,
and it's sort of...
Malcolm Tucker.
I remember Jack Straw came to see me when the Thick of It thing was all starting, and he says, this is really dangerous. What do you mean? He says, they've not been able to get us on policy, they've not been able to get Tony, so this is how they're going to try and get him. As sort of, you know, he's not really his own man. Now, I don't think that's true, because Tony was... you know, his own man and did could lead and what have you. But I do, I've thought a lot about the spitting image thing. I think less so John Major, I think, because that, you know, he actually survived quite long. Yeah, it was almost endearing, the whole peace thing and what have you. But I think David Steele never quite recovered from that.
You were quite worried about the thick of it when it came out.
I wasn't, but Jack definitely came to see me and he said this whole thing about a combination of that and Bremner and Bird and Fortune. Do you remember Rory Bremner was Tony and they had that big fat guy doing me. He didn't look like me at all.
He wasn't even an athlete.
He was much better looking.
But he was like, he genuinely thought it was worrying. And there was a part of me that was worried about it. I love it now. I love the thick of it now. But yeah, there was a little bit of me that was a bit worried about it at the time. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Well, you've been hearing from all along our special guest, Alistair Campbell, one of the most feared men in all spin doctoring, now in his new nice incarnation as a champion of Remain.
Well, only here. I mean, you know, I'd love to go and do Brexit Central.
But you mentioned the thick of it there, which is probably, you know, by sort of implication, kind of enhanced this sort of reputation you had. Do you sort of look at that reputation and think, well, I wasn't that bad. Like, this is a kind of, it's a tough job.
Yeah, but I don't think, I mean, I don't think Malcolm Tucker's that bad in that...
Jesus Christ.
What I mean by that is that it's a caricature of somebody who's trying to keep control.
And the only person who swears more than Ian Dunn.
I do swear a lot, but I don't swear like Malcolm Tucker. Although he and I once had a swear-off, you know, in real life.
Brilliant.
A charity thing, we had a swear-off and it was one of the city traders that gives all their money to 9/11 families. And I was doing it for one of the mental health charities and he was doing it for Bernardo's. But it got stopped halfway through after are we allowed to swear on this programme?
Yes.
Okay. So I did this thing.
Watch out, family listeners.
Which ended with me, so I was telling a story of my uncle. Who was a farmer, and I said, and he was this about this milking machine that didn't work, and I said, and he turned, and he says, this thing is fucking fucked, and I'm fucking fucked to fucking fuckery with it, right? And we were getting points for F's and C's. Yeah. I don't think we did C words, but anyway. So these guys in the city traders floor, they all sort of thought I'd done quite well. Before Peter Capaldi could even get going, some guy came charging in to stop the whole thing because the entire thing was being beamed right round the building, including into the staff creche. So it was a great Malcolm Tucker moment. But no, I think it's... I don't quite understand this reputation thing at all. I don't really. I think I'm... Look, I did a very difficult job with the media at a very difficult time when they were changing into something that they were not when I was back in the day when I was a journalist. Mm. And I think we did it well most of the time. And I think actually a lot of the image thing comes from people who actually have never had anything to do with me. You talk to middle management at BBC, who I've never met, and they'll sit around in their dinner party saying, oh, God, he was never off the phone, he was this, that, the other. But actually you talk to the people that I did deal with, and I don't think really there's that much to it. I think that, you know, I was tough and I defended the government and Tony, and I still do defend Tony. But I think it's, I don't know. I remember Andrew Rawnsley, the Observer guy, he once said to me, he says, the problem you've got, he said, is that we, the press, find you, me, more interesting than we find a lot of the politicians. Added to which, I was the person they saw all the time. So it was in their interest to kind of build me up into this kind of slightly weird mythical figure.
Would you? I mean, the famous thing is always a thing when you become the story, there's a problem, and you became the story pretty early on. So you sort of disprove it in a way because there was at least years to go after you became the story. When everything kept on functioning.
I'll tell you one thing that really surprised me. When I first took the job in 1994, maybe this is naive, but I remember it was Robert Shrimsley wrote this big profile in the Telegraph. Is this the man who can deliver victory for Labour or something? I thought, what's it all about? It was called, these people that I'd worked with for years, suddenly they're all writing these profiles. And I'm like, So you're right, I did become the story a lot. And I think the interesting thing about Tony as a leader, I remember once him actually saying to me, during one of the many kind of heavy periods when I was getting a lot of flack, and Tony understood that we were lightning, you know, me, Peter Mandelson, Derry Irvine at times, Charlie Faulkner at times. We were lightning conductors. We were the ones that would take it. And that was fine. I understood that was part of my job. But Tony would sometimes say, "Are you okay with this?" He would always be the one almost articulating to me why they were doing it. And the reason he would say is, look, they know that you're important to me. They find it hard to take me out. Therefore, they're going to try and take away the legs. Mm. And, you know, as long as your boss is in that mindset, the rest of it doesn't really matter. And I definitely reached a point around about the fuel protest. I reached a point, honestly, I just didn't care anymore what they said. I just didn't care. And that's liberating once you got that.
So as somebody observing the Remain campaign as it unfolded, as somebody that knew about campaigns and about messaging, I mean, in hindsight, everybody, including the people who worked at Stronger In, will go, well, we did this wrong, we were unlucky there, et cetera, et cetera. What did you think at the time? Were the failings that people talk about now, to your eyes, were they obvious at the time? Like, oh my God, you need to be doing this and not that.
I wasn't sort of integral to the campaign. I was involved in the campaign. I was dipping in and out of the campaign. I was campaigning on my own way in different places.
Of course, yeah.
I think that, you know, I'm a great believer in big campaigns. You have to have big strategy, and of course, the entire thing was driven by Cameron responding tactically to a particular problem. So that's the thing that. From that moment, I kind of worried. Definitely towards the end. I mean, I can remember, what's the name on the Stronger In campaign? Lucy.
Oh, yeah.
Rogers. Lucy Rogers?
Pass.
Can't remember. So, anyway, I remember a few weeks out saying to her, listen, this is lost. And she was like, why? Because I just keep running into people who I'm really, really surprised when they tell me they're going to vote Leave. And particularly because I go to most Burnley games, it was like, now I know, you know, Burnley voted very, very Leave, but it wasn't just the people that I might have expected to say they were voting Leave. I was meeting so many people who I didn't expect, people I thought I knew and who I thought shared my kind of outlook and politics and what have you. So there were time, and I did have an in to people in Number 10, and I did have an in to Osborne, and I was kind of feeding in messages. I did worry that the Project Fear thing was not good enough. I think that, and it's hard to fight for a status quo.
Yeah.
In the modern age, against an insurgent, it's hard to fight just for the status quo. That's why in this campaign now, we have got to be the status quo is Brexit.
Yeah.
We have got to fight what they are trying to pretend is this sort of, you know, this great future that we've got based on the fact that this Brexit cannot be touched. But yeah, there was lots going on that. But I'll be honest, until the last few weeks, I thought it'd be fine. I did.
How long had you got that channel with George Osborne that had been functioning throughout the campaign?
Yeah, up to a point, yeah.
And you were sort of just contributing sort of campaign suggestions, slogan suggestions, counter-arguments?
Thoughts, yeah. And then Craig Oliver asked me to go in and help out on some of the debate preparation and that kind of thing. I talked to Craig quite a lot. I was worried about the campaign from the perspective of it felt very one-dimensional. But I understand it. I've got to say, it's the same with Hillary Clinton. I actually think hindsight is a wonderful thing, but if you were to say, wind back, what campaign would you advise Hillary Clinton to fight? That's the campaign. But she was up against this opponent that we hadn't really worked out and nobody could understand. And it's the same with Brexit. I think that, for example, looking back, Barack Obama basically says vote Remain. Barack Obama's very, very popular in Britain. America's an incredibly powerful country. You're going to bank that and think that's going to work for you.
Yeah.
I think looking back, it probably worked against.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have said that now. At the time, I thought, good, excellent. All those business people coming out and saying what they did. At the time, I thought, good.
Mm.
Looking back...
No.
Doesn't look quite so wise.
You've advised people like Macron and things like that. And earlier on, you reflected on the 90s when the Tories sort of hated themselves and their different factions more than Labour. And what one might say the same is true now of the current Labour Party. Mm. And you and I have an old friend in common. I'm very much a Charles Kennedy liberal. And after he died, you remarked that he'd said to you about, not really jokingly saying, setting up a left-wing Scottish party. So in the vein of all of that, you know, how likely do you think it is that some kind of new thing can emerge here in the UK and some kind of pro-European guise?
I don't know. And I don't I don't think it should just be seen. If that were to happen, it shouldn't just be about Europe, because I think that would be, you know, one of the reasons the Lib, you know, one of the big surprises of the last election to me is that the Lib Dems did so badly. Mm. Now, there's all sorts of reasons, but if you think about it, what was their one defining point? It was that they were very, very pro-Europe, and they were basically saying there's got to be another referendum. So now, other parties partially may have caught up with them, and certainly, you know, other people have caught up with that in terms of thinking we should have a look at the final deal. But I do think that the politics as it is at the moment, I think it's unsustainable. I think it's unsustainable in our democracy to have millions of people feeling at the moment that nobody's speaking for them.
Mm. But we've got a very different setup in terms of our electoral system.
Yeah, for sure.
And how would we
And also, we had a referendum on changing the voting system, don't forget.
Yeah.
And people said no, because they couldn't be asked.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's not straightforward, this. People, if I had a pound for every single person who just walking around, even, it's happened three times already today, people just walking around saying things like, why doesn't David Miliband come back? Or why don't you just start up a new party? Or, you know, why can't you just get rid of Corbyn? Whatever it might be, right? Yeah. And it's all very well to say that, but then you've got to, you know, my worry at the moment about a new party, and, you know, just remember with the SDP, say what you like about them, but the four people who led its creation, they were big, big figures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, who is there in the PLP comparable at the moment to Owen, Jenkins,
Shirley Williams,
and Bill Rogers, right? So, and is there not a danger? This is what a lot of Labour people will be thinking. Is there not a danger, regardless of what people think of Corbyn? And I do think Corbyn on Brexit has been an absolute disgrace. And I'm getting a bit irritated with Keir as well. I just don't think he's pushing the boat hard enough. Is there not a danger that all that does in the end is actually help / guarantee the re-election of one of the worst governments we've ever had? But so we're so not spoilt for choice. But I do think this is I think our politics as it is unsustainable. Something has to give. I just don't know what and when.
Because one thing that you keep hearing a lot, because in such febrile times, is that sort of centrism in that kind of 90s onwards incarnation, you know, is sort of dead, and now one has to move to sort of to the left or to the right.
People are only saying that because that's what's happening.
Well,
the centre wasn't on the ballot paper last election.
Well, this is the thing where people...
Macron, you mentioned Macron. Macron managed, brilliantly in my view, to take the... actually, when you look at his CV and his track record, he's hardly kind of, you know... Yeah. He's hardly the anti-elitist. No. But he managed to make himself the outsider, coming in from outside politics, as it were. But actually saying the two things that I think do define what I would define as sensible centrist policy, which is basically you've got to be dedicated to try and generate wealth, but you've got to make sure that it's spread fairly.
But we've really got to come across as people with passion and new ideas and relevance, and not be some kind of coalition of stale failures, which I think there is a sort of danger of a lot of the centrist voices that we still hear.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And it's,
and they are men mostly.
There's some women, but no, you're right. You're right, and I think that it's like you're at Best for Britain, okay? Now I think that Best for Britain do lots of good stuff, but I think you've got to be really, really careful about this idea that politicians are bad, and that politicians are one of the reasons why we lost the referendum. Because let's be frank, who do the public identify with? It'd be great if there were these new voices coming through. It'd be fantastic if the loads of I've been trying the Our Future, Our Choice, and Femi and these guys. They're great. And I've regularly been saying to the media when they phone me up, right? I can't do it.
Have them on.
But I can when I can. Yeah. But I'll tell you what, I'll give you a phone number for these guys, because we need to get these the younger voices out. But in Parliament. I mean, I was saying to somebody earlier, my parents, when I was growing up, I reckon my parents, they weren't that political, but I reckon they could have named 50 to 60 MPs, recognised them off the telly. I mean, today, we're talking about a very, very small pool. And I think that we're a little bit victims of our success in terms of how dominant New Labour was in the political landscape when we were in power, because we still, you know, whether it's Blair, Mandelson, Brown, me, the people who are involved in that whole New Labour thing, there's still an interest in that in terms of getting us onto the media and talking about this. But that just feeds into this idea that we're figures of the past when actually what we need are voices of the future.
Well, you'll be well aware of this, that every time Tony Blair pops up and says something about Europe, which invariably I agree with, there's this, you know, people, someone just shouts Iraq and then sort of don't listen to him. Do you feel like that's just... That is his fate now, that whatever he says, and not just him, but, you know, his former colleagues are just sort of, what they say is just going to be tainted.
That's his fate for a certain section. I think a lot of this is about the media. I had breakfast this morning with Mete Coban, who runs My Life, My Say. Mm. And he was making the point that, you know, he's 25, right? Now, he's very, very political. And he was telling me, he met Tony at some do the other day, and he said he put a picture of himself and Tony on Twitter. And he said the response from his generation was, wow, you know, he's such a big name and he's such a big figure. So I think we've got to be, I think you talk about the bubble. Now, I'm not saying Iraq isn't a very, very big issue for a lot of people. But the thing I always say to Tony is, if you believe something, same as John Major with it, I thought his speech recently was brilliant. Mm. If you believe something and you do have the ability to get your voice out there, you've got to use it. So don't be put off. And you know, I'll tell you, going around the place, yes, it's true, you bump into people who go, oh, Tony Blair, I believed in him so much, now I hate him. I do meet people like that. I meet an awful lot of people who say to me, God, I'll tell you what, the country was a lot better off when you guys were in charge. And, you know, that's...
I mean, I never thought I'd find myself saying, bring back Osborne, all is forgiven. But, you know, there have been moments where I thought... Oh.
Well, I had a little minor dust-up on Twitter with someone where, again, Iraq was the kind of...
Can I just say, by the way, all dust-ups on Twitter are minor.
Yeah, okay, fair, good. So you had category error there. Yeah, I just had a standard dust-up on Twitter with someone, again, where sort of Iraq was the argument ender as far as they saw it. And if we're talking about kind of trust in sort of politicians and indeed in the media, and this sense that, you know, that they lie to, you know, to get what they want, do you feel that the legacy of Iraq there and arguments about dossiers and so on, you know, still casts a shadow over people's sort of faith in
it? Does if people want it to. It does if people want it to. I mean, I think that the most institutions, and I don't think you can just put this down to social media. I do think the nature of our media and the way it's changed is a big factor in this. And I'm not saying it's not a reasonable thing to say, right, there's Tony Blair. He took the country into a conflict that millions of people were opposed to. British soldiers died. It had, you know, the consequences were complicated and not and very messy. Added to which, one of the reasons for doing it turned out not to be true. I understand the anger for that. What I won't do, and never will do, because I was there and I know the thinking behind the whole process, what I will never do is accept the conspiracy theories or accept that we lied. What we did was base a decision in part, and this is the other thing that happens because it became so controversial. It's like, well, you know, we only went to war because of that. We went to, you know, we took out Saddam for all sorts of reasons, one of which was his history, one of which was the breach of UN SCRs down the years and so forth. So, yes, it casts a shadow. But I'll tell you, when we talk about learning the lessons of Iraq, one of the things I really, really worry about, not least looking at Syria and looking at what's happening with Russia at the moment, is one of the lessons that our politicians have learned is don't do really, really difficult things. And that's, you know, let me bring it back to Brexit. I think, I'm not saying this is in her thinking, but when I was talking about not doing difficult things, I actually think if Theresa May at the moment were on her own with her conscience and was asking herself, as a leader, doing the right thing for the country, what do I do now? She'd do the difficult thing. She'd say, do you know what? I've looked at this every which way. There's no way we're going to do this without damaging the country. So I'm not going to do it. Mm. Now, bloody difficult, really difficult, going against the will of the people and all that. But that is, and I think what's happened in our politics more generally, you see it right around the world, but you see it particularly here, is this sense of leaders following rather than leading. Now, say what you like about Tony, say what you like about Thatcher, but the reason we put people in positions of leadership is to lead.
Do you feel that this period that we're in of kind of populist rage, of relatively weak centrists on you know, the right and the left side, do you see that as the new normal for some years to come? Or considering the costs that it's obviously exacting so far on Britain and America, that it's kind of a spasm? I wonder how long this is going to go on. It's going to be a rearrangement for...
I really don't know. Okay. You were talking about GQ. I did an interview with Al Gore last year. And so we were talking about climate change, inevitably, because it's his big thing. And I was saying, like, you know, you must just be... What are you going to do? You've got this guy, Trump, president now. What the hell are you going to do? And he basically said, we're just going to have to ignore him. Work round him.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, but he's the president. Yeah, no, he's the president. He's got a lot of power. Yeah, no, he's got a lot of power. Now... and what he's been doing since then, he has been kind of working with cities, working with states, working with governors, going to different countries. So I don't know if it's a spasm. I have a bigger worry.
I'm slightly worried because this is a big worry. So if yours is bigger,
well, he's getting it out of his bag.
I'll tell you what, I'm getting my bag. I'm reading this book at the moment.
This is great radio right now.
Is it? So, yeah.
How bleak is this book?
It's called The Holocaust.
Pretty bleak. Pretty bleak.
Okay.
By Lawrence Rees. And I'm reading it. And, you know, I don't know why I picked this up to read it. Probably because I was so depressed. It was like, I don't know.
That'll cheer me up, yeah.
I don't know. Anyway,
they didn't have the girl on the train. So.
I'm going to read that. And I've got to be honest, I can't put it down because, I mean, there's not that, the big story, I know. But I'll tell you what is extraordinary. I'm reading this section at the moment. So I do a lot of campaign on mental health, right? Mm. I'm reading this bit at the moment. This is long before the Holocaust, right? Where Hitler, who hated mentally ill people and hated the disabled, and he's co-opting doctors. This is kind of before the war. He's co-opting doctors to kind of basically to kill them, okay? And I've got to the bit at the moment where they're trying out these valves, because actually doctors found it easier if they could just turn a valve and have this gas come in and take people out
rather than have to inject them. Yeah, of course, yeah.
And that was like, you know, so you've got these Nazis who are sort of... Now, when I did Tony for GQ, we had this argument because I was sort of saying, look, do you not feel, if you look at things in the historic sweep, there's just too much of a feel of the 30s about, particularly with Trump in the States. Yeah. And he would say, oh, don't be so ridiculous. You know, you can't compare him to Hitler. And I said, well, hold on a minute. Hitler didn't go for the judges and the journalists for quite a long time. Trump was doing it in week one. And so I sort of think that this right-wing populism, and I'm not sure the left-wing populism is much better, in terms of its kind of, you know, intellectual rigour, I worry it's not a spasm. I worry that, you know, if you think about it, I'm 60, so if you think that my generation, pretty blessed in terms of, as Brits, as the life that we've led in terms of, you know, you're looking really worried over there. You're looking really worried. but the, you know, so we've, you know, we haven't had national service. We haven't had to, you know, we've been involved in wars, but, you know, we've not all had to go to war. We've been pretty lucky on the kind of environmental catastrophe front. So I just worry that we're entering a really, really dark and dangerous period of history. And one of the things that's extraordinary when you read the Hitler story is how much other countries, including ours, were kind of willing, wanting to say, oh, it's not going to be as bad as we think. Oh, we can manage him now. You know, most famously, changing his piece of paper. There's lots before that.
It's funny, though, because a lot of people do say, oh, this is not as, you know, don't get hysterical. I remember lots of people saying that about Trump, and it's not as bad as you think. But it's like sometimes, I'm not saying it will be, but sometimes it is. Sometimes also, it really is as bad as you think.
No, but also the normalisation of this stuff. So, like, you know, how has it become normalised that, for example, we now know on the government's own assessment that there is no model they have looked at and there is no deal available that is not going to make us poorer, right? Yeah. We know that now. And yet, have you heard people in pubs talking about that? Do you think people really are caring about that? Or are they not just saying, oh, get on with it? And I think this normalisation of stuff that is bad is kind of, I don't know, I think it's dangerous.
I think that part, it's very common in British psyche as well. It's just like, well, I mean, it's a very popular poster and tea towel, keep calm and carry on. But it's like, it's going to be okay. We've been in worse situations before. And I feel like that kind of blind, unthinking sort of optimism among just many ordinary voters is one of the big problems that we have in terms of shifting public opinion.
I'll tell you what they're just like, oh, you know. I'll tell you something that's interesting about this public opinion. I don't know if this is borne out by the stuff that you've seen, but I mean, you look at a lot of the polling at the moment, and it's actually quite depressing.
Very depressing.
In that people aren't necessarily changing their mind. But I'll tell you one thing that I think is really interesting, and there's a reason why there are not things called non-voters. It's they're people who don't vote. But what's really interesting about the analysis of non-voters on the referendum? Now, you might think non-voters, well, that means, you know, maybe poorer people. It might be people who don't engage in current affairs that much, and what have you. In which case, there'd be, you'd think, if they were asked, had you voted, or if you were voting now, what would you vote? You'd think they'd be towards the kind of leave. And actually, they're 3-1 if they had a vote now. This is why we've got to keep fighting for a vote on the deal. There's 3-1, actually, that they would vote to remain. Now, I think what's happening there is that whether it's us on our side or passionate leavers on their side, nobody wants to admit that they might have got it wrong. And that's what's keeping it close. But those people who didn't vote, who are kind of almost entering the debate for the first time, it's interesting, they're coming out with a very, very different answer.
That also works demographically, though, doesn't it? Because they're probably people who weren't old enough to vote.
Some of them, for sure.
And you picked Ian up earlier about not talking about a second referendum. I'm going to pick you up on saying we mustn't talk about a vote on the deal. We must talk about a vote on the terms of Brexit, because the framing of the word deal makes people think is a better deal be done. It's just that Theresa May isn't very good at negotiating a deal, so let's let somebody else try and do it.
Consider it slack.
Look at these two campaigners over there. It's a very deprived
about the words.
About the words. Ian has never thought about his words.
I think about my fucking words all the time.
And that's pretty much the end of the show. Thanks to our special guest, Alistair Campbell. What are you up to next?
I'm actually going off tonight to do something for to promote Bradford. Bradford's kind of reaching out and trying to develop a new profile in the world.
Great. So make sure they all go to the Leeds March on Saturday.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And then what else am I doing? I'm finding life very difficult for lots of reasons. One of the reasons I find life difficult is because here we are in the middle of the football season and Burnley are going 3 weeks without a game. I'm finding that quite hard.
And me and Dorian are doing our best impression of giving a shit about what you just said.
Do you not care about football? Do you really not care about football?
I thought our faces projected a lot of emotional anguish over that fact.
No, you don't care.
No, I don't. It's not that I don't.
You don't care.
I just don't.
Don't
know.
Don't pretend. I don't mind. I'd rather the people like you said they don't care than people that come on to can't stand are people who pretend.
Well, you'll get on very well with us then.
Okay, good. You really don't care.
Couldn't give a shit.
No, so I'm just carrying on with life. I'm off to write another new European piece and, you know, keep my morale up.
Good stuff. Well, yeah. Maybe you're not reading the right book for the morale.
Maybe. I am. No, maybe I am.
Maybe I am. It's like,
no, I think it's really important.
Things can only get worse.
It's not that long ago.
No.
It's not that long ago.
Well, listen, I'm reading The Origins of Totalitarianism, so I can't really.
Yeah.
Who am I to judge? And thanks to Naomi and Ian as ever. Every week we finish the show with a snippet of a European language. If you're fluent in one, then we could use your voice to sign off. Just record a sound clip of something short, encouraging and non-libelous in a quiet room and email it to us at info@romaniacs.com with an English translation, please.
I can do that in two languages.
Oh, hello. Do some for us.
Do you want to quickly do one for us?
What do you want me to say? Alors, le Brexit, c'est une catastrophe pour mon pays et pour le vôtre.
I don't know why you talking in French is so funny, but it is.
Well, in the meantime, here's listener Maria Brooks with a bit of German.
Eure deutsche Königin könnt ihr behalten, alles andere bekommen wir.
And now, hands in the air as we play out with Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop and raise a Churchillian pint glass of champagne to our Patreon backers.
Thanks from me to Joanna Pryor, Neil Champion, Gavin Clark, Rob Hammond, and the mysterious APK.
And it's a soft border by Chi. From me to Maria Pritchard, Liam Collins, Darren Lethley, Owen Coburn and Ahmed Ibrahim.
And finally, thanks from me to Alastair Jarrett, Richard Lloyd, Adam Cole, Liam Dutton and Richard Leeming. Brexit willing, we'll see you next week.
Remaniacs was presented by Dorian Lenski with Naomi Smith and Ian Dunt. Studio production is by Sophie Black and the producer was me, Andrew Harrison. Remaniacs is a Podmasters production.